So, starting over again. So, this evening we're going to talk about the fourth foundation of mindfulness, which in the translation that was in your packet of the Satipatthana Sutta is called foundations of mindfulness, but the great frames of reference, which I thought, you know, sometimes these different translations sort of shine a light and open things up a little bit. And what that opened up for me was realizing that with mindfulness, we have to be mindful of something. With consciousness, we have to be conscious of something. And these foundations are the frames of reference for the operation of mindfulness itself, or bare attention. It points to the way that the subject and object arise together. The mindfulness and the object of mindfulness. And in the introduction, Tanissaro Bhikkhu says that sati, mindfulness, is sometimes translated as non-reactive awareness, free from agendas, simply present with whatever arises, which sounds a lot like how we talk about zazen, no gaining intention. But he goes on to say, the activity of satipatthana, however, definitely has a motivating agenda, the desire for awakening, which is classed not as a cause of suffering, but as part of the path to its ending. The role of mindfulness is to keep the mind properly grounded in the present moment in a way that will keep it on the path. And the fourth foundation, I think, really makes that explicit. It's the mindfulness of objects of mind, of what in the translation in your packet he calls mental qualities. But I think objects of mind or mental contents, which are which is the way that this is rendered in many other translations, really brings it out more. The objects of mind or mental contents are the dharmas, the uppercase dharmas, which are the teachings of the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas, and the lowercase dharmas, which are the 10,000 things, anything that your mind can focus on. It just means objects of mind. So this fourth foundation of mindfulness is sometimes called the realm of dharma or the realm of dharmas. And it's what is made clear in that part of the sutra is how they operate together for good or for ill, depending on how we practice with them. So it's in this fourth foundation where it's pretty clear how that agenda of the satipatthana, of mindfulness, to use mindfulness to keep us on the path, how that is really explicitly operating. Tanissaro Bhikkhu talks about how this is a place where we are actively getting engaged in maximizing skillful mental qualities and minimizing unskillful ones. So the dharmas that are focused on and explored most explicitly in this sutra include both skillful things that have to do with skillful and unskillful mental qualities, hindrances, fetters, and also factors of enlightenment. One book that I like a lot that focuses on the Satipatthana is this book, Nyanaponikatera's The Heart of Buddhist Meditation, and it's about the Satipatthana Sutta. And he says, the practice of direct observation of circumstances that favor or obstruct the arising and non-arising of the hindrances, fetters, and factors of enlightenment which arise within the experiences of daily life, so that the single experiences of life interpenetrate with the Dharma, with the teaching, especially the Four Noble Truths. As we go into more detail about this, and Jerry's going to go into quite a bit more detail about how they all kind of weave and interpenetrate, you see that mutual activity.
Do you want that light raised?
I think it's okay.
Because I can put a zafu under it and put a fire.
I think it's pretty good.
It's okay.
Yeah. So that our life, our experience of one dharma after another, one phenomenon, one thing. The lamp is a lowercase dharma. The cup, a ballot, an election, a plank in a political platform. All of those dharmas. The action of our practice includes the uppercase dharmas with which we operate in relation to those. And the spiritual practice becomes our life. So there are really a whole lot of dharmas, and I brought this book. It's The List of Lists, and it is a list of dharmas, of uppercase dharmas. So there are the ones, the twos, the tens, the 15s, the 18s, the 27s, and on and on and on, and all these amazing lists. I just opened to the 14s, the 14 sins of slandering the law, which are haughtiness, neglect, self-centeredness, shallowness, sensuality, irrationality, unbelief, sullenness, doubting, slander, scorning goodness, hating goodness, jealousy of goodness, and grudging goodness. So it goes all the way up to the 3,000, which are the 3,000 realms in Tendai. And when Bruce and I were looking at this earlier, you were the one who said there it's missing the 75... What?
No.
Peter. The 75...
Well, the list of dharmas in all the various schools have just slightly different lists, and they're all, 75 to 100 or so, So those ones don't appear there, but...
And I was looking for the seven niyamas, which are sometimes called the laws of the universe, and karma is just one of those. There are the laws of physics and biology and seeds and some other laws. And that wasn't in here, so there are even more lists than are here. We all got kind of... just sort of sucked into looking at this because it's kind of fun. But I think that just the bulkiness of it shows the extent to which the complexity of the whole thing and the extent to which there's been an effort to penetrate that complexity. So in the Satipatthana Sutta, the dharmas that are focused on there are the five hindrances: desire, aversion, torpor, sometimes called sloth, restlessness and anxiety, and doubt or uncertainty. So those are the five hindrances. The five clinging aggregates, which we call the five skandhas, form, feeling, perceptions, formations, and consciousness. The six senses, eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, and mind. The seven factors of awakening, which include mindfulness, effort or persistence, rapture, serenity, concentration, and analysis of qualities or investigation of the Dharma. That's a list we don't rattle off real often in our practice, the seven factors of enlightenment. And then the Four Noble Truths, and particularly the Eightfold Path, where right mindfulness is one of the factors. Jerry's going to talk about a lot about the interpenetration of all of these dharmas with each other, and a lot of this sutra is concerned with that, how the clinging attribute aggregates are the source of suffering, which Tanissaro Bhikkhu in your packet renders as stress, which I think is another word that kind of opens it up and shines a light and broadens the sense of it. At least for me, it does. So Nyanaponika says, the dharmas should be absorbed as much as possible into the thought patterns of daily life and should replace those concepts which cannot stand the scrutiny of right understanding. So avoiding the hindrances and the fetters and developing the factors of awakening and practicing the Eightfold Path. It was also interesting to find him talking about things that cannot stand the scrutiny of right understanding, and it made me think back to Alan's talk about the Kalama Sutta and how the Buddha said, you know, we are to subject everything to the scrutiny of our own testing, to not believe anything just because it's taught, but we have to prove everything true for ourselves. And subjecting it to the scrutiny of right understanding. So in addition to that, I wanted to talk about the parts of this that are repeated over and over again in all of the foundations of mindfulness. I think it was Peter who talked about those repetitive parts that often get rendered as dot, 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 because we've encountered them and they're wordy and they're long and they keep coming back and keep coming back. And sometimes it seems like they're there because it's an oral tradition and it helps people remember. But actually, I think it's the most important part. It's how to do it. And what repeats over and over again is in the practice of mindfulness, the monk remains focused on the body, the breath, feeling, the mind state, the object of mind, remaining focused on it in and of itself. In and of itself. Putting aside reference to the world. So I think what that's really describing is bare attention. But it's what it called up for me was I used to go to a yoga class, and the teacher would say to feel the the asana, the posture inside the body, to know and understand and explore the posture inside the body, not trying to make it look like her, or not trying to make it look like our idea of an ideal of how it would look. So remaining focused on whatever it is in and of itself, putting aside reference to the world. And then remaining ardent, alert, and mindful. So I think this describes the quality of effort. I think it describes effort itself, the effort of zazen that that is simply zazen for the sake of zazen. Ardent, alert, and mindful. I got really interested in effort. I sat the election session, or walked the election session. And we were really involved in putting forth a lot of effort without getting attached to results. So I got really interested in effort. What is effort? Just as effort. And I think this describes kind of the flavor of it. The alertness, the paying attention, and the word ardent. A kind of a devotion. So ardent, alert, and mindful, remaining focused on the phenomenon of origin or of origination, remaining focused on the phenomenon of passing away, remaining focused on the phenomenon of origination and passing away, which is what we do in zazen, watching things arise, abide, and pass away. He's pointing to not watching the thing itself arising, abiding, and passing away, but that phenomenon of arising, of origination, and passing away. And I think, for me, I experience it in that time between the end of the out-breath and the beginning of the in-breath, when somehow there is that origination of the breath. And applying that to all of these frames of reference, these foundations, the body, the breath, feeling, mind state, and then these objects of mind, how they first begin to make themselves seen. Somebody once described the attitude of mindfulness as being like two sumo wrestlers, and they're poised, very balanced, very, very carefully, and each one trying to see the movement of the other one before it actually quite begins, so they can be ahead of the ahead of that, attending so carefully that you can see the origination of the movement right at the beginning, not the movement itself, but that origination, that that spot between when it's not there and when it is there. So remaining focused on dharmas, on the Dharma in and of itself, putting aside reference to the world, ardent, alert, and mindful, effortful, remaining focused on the phenomenon of origination, of passing away, of origination and passing away. Mindfulness that there is a whatever it is. Mindfulness that there is a body. Mindfulness that there is feeling. Mindfulness that there is a state of mind. Mindfulness that there is a Dharma. Is maintained simply to the extent of knowledge and recollection. And she remains independent, unsustained by, not clinging to anything in the world. Empty of whatever is not there. So just this Dharma, just this thing, just this teaching, just this, and nothing extra, which is what we do in Shikantaza. So as I studied this, it really began to seem to me like a description of Zazen practice, of how we actually do it, even though it's coming from a different approach to Buddhist practice and understanding. Doing Zazen practice with regard to the actual experience of Dharma in daily life. Remaining focused on it in and of itself, making an effort, watching it arise and pass away, and being mindful of it in and of itself. So it reminded me of an instruction I heard once of how to listen to a Dharma talk. And the instruction was to just let it come in. Not to think about it, not to try to remember it, not to try to hang on to it, but just to let it come in. Being attentive to it and mindful of it as it comes in. Not thinking about it. And then finding that at exactly the right moment, somehow that phrase that shines a light on what's happening, that word or that bit of Dharma arises right in the middle of daily life when I need it. And Nyanaponika Thera in here says that among the Mahayana schools, Chan and Zen are closest to the spirit of Satipatthana. And he points out that what we have, what they have in common is direct confrontation with actuality, including one's mind and the objects of mind, merging of everyday life with meditation practice, and the transcending of conceptual thought with direct observation, the emphasis on the here and now. So it was pretty striking to me. You know, it felt like he started out saying, no, that's not what's going on here, and then wound up there in the conclusion. So I'm going to stop now and see if you have questions or comments, or Jerry, if you have something you want to throw in.
I'll take my turn.
Okay. Jeff?
What came up for me as you were speaking is that when we sit, we just sit. There is no effort, there is nothing that we do. We breathe. But as I've listened to you speak about this so skillfully, it was quite nice, thank you for that, is that if this is a 24-hour practice, and I practice throughout the day, these are the awarenesses that arise as I kind of have a series of nows, as my day flows and as time flows. It's the awareness of watching things arise and go back down, to realize that arising does create a passing away, that all of these things come and all of these things go, and it makes me tune into the flow, and it allows the flow to happen. I'm more willing to let go and to not seize any part of the middle of the flow and try to make it something that it's not, just to experience it and to be exactly what it is.
And as we internalize, as the flow includes receiving teaching, mm-hmm. that becomes part of it.
Yes. You know? Yes, yeah. Thank you very much.
Did you have a question? I'm sorry, I don't know your name.
Joanna.
Yeah. All right.
I just want to say, okay. You very, very aptly described the similarity of our experience in Zazen with looking at, kind of getting this understanding of the multiplicity of dharmas, sort of like the contents of Zazen experiences, all these little pieces that just sort of go by one after another.
Yeah.
It's kind of like the knee, all the little stuff that's happening.
Yeah. And then just recognizing it.
Mm-hmm.
I had an experience recently where I was really recognizing my own hindrances, while just in the midst of them. First experiencing the suffering of it, and then being able to name, oh, that's that hindrance that's coming up, and then to watch it, watch the sensation in my body, watch the knowledge that it was a hindrance, mm-hmm. not what I want to feed, not where I want to go, and simply to allow that to affect, to kind of watch it affect what was going on rather than make it affect that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Bob?
I was struck and appreciated your description of the flow of origination and passing away, which the Satipatthana Sutra directs us to. As it so happens today, I was reading a little something about how Stephen Hawking? Makes the point that time is a dimension like space, and thus there's no beginning or end. And on the one hand, and which brought me back to Genghis Khan, how on the one hand, as all things are Buddha Dharma, there's birth and death. There's origination and passing away. As the myriad things are without an abiding self, there's no origination and no passing away. I mean, we chant this pretty much every day with the Heart Sutra. It's the core of the Heart Sutra. And in sitting with breath, there's that moment in between one breath and another, where on the one hand there's a transition, which you can be very aware of, and on the other hand, at a certain moment, there's no stopping or starting.
One moment is not, and
well,
the next minute...
That's right. It does not flow from moment to moment.
It's moment, moment,
right.
Moment.
Each moment, moment is eternal. I don't know that I'm going anywhere with this, but the Satipatthana, I guess what I struggle with the Satipatthana Sutra is it seems heavily weighted in one direction, in the coming and going direction, and watching it appear and watching it disappear, as compared to some of the more dialectical Buddhist Mahayana pieces. And I'm wondering how you reconcile the two practices. Oh, so are they two practices, or are they one practice?
That's an interesting question. I'm thinking about when Alexandra and I did a class on the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, and that question was raised at the beginning. You know, is there some conflict or some disagreement between this kind of approach and what we do? And it didn't seem to me at the time, and it doesn't seem to me now, but I don't know. And I particularly appreciated finding that non-contradiction right in the middle of this. On the other hand, you know, different strokes for different folks. You know, what is helpful on the path, in the practice, for one person may be rather different from what is helpful for another, and they don't necessarily stand against each other or contradict each other, I don't think.
I keep coming back to Dogen's statement that the Buddha way is basically leaping clear of the many and the one.
Yeah.
Which is sort of impossible, except that that's what we are.
Are you raising your hand over there?
Yeah, I have it, but is there a hand for me?
I feel so unschooled with all of this, as we were talking about earlier. What comes to mind in this question is also, is there any relevance to it being the relative and the absolute, that that looking at just this moment, just this moment, just this moment would kind of align with the absolute perspective and the kind of more wave of coming and going and abiding, and, you know, would feel like the more relative, because this is the everyday world and we have that sensation.
Yeah, is it a particle or a wave? Where is it when we're trying to look at it? Where was it before we started trying to look at it?
In terms of, you know, Bob's question on this basic, you know, sort of issue is, like, you know, basically it's like, you know, the difference between, say, this, which is really kind of like the dynamics of how the mind works, how things happen, as against, like, in the Madhyamaka, which really kind of talking about kind of just the nature of things ultimately, or just, you know, and I think there's kind of like that issue of, like, okay, this is the way things are, in a sense, but then the fact is, this is how our minds work, this is what goes on moment by moment, you know, it's like however it happened that things got carried along from the previous moment, here we have something, and yet everything has no, you know, permanent reality, but things do happen, and we do have cause and effect. We have, you know, conditions. We have causes and conditions that are just sort of, it's like stewing around in this big pot. But it's kind of like in physics. It's like, you know, there's the dynamics and then there's the statics.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one's the static, the other's the dynamic.
Pierre?
I think these problems are almost impossible to rationalize.
Thanks.
Almost impossible.
Studying Abhidharma, you know, there's a huge amount of energy in scholastic Buddhism that's trying to solve the problem of the connections between the continuous flow of moments. You know, yes, we have discrete moments, but what is the connection? Is there any, you know, is there continuity? You know, well, then you have to rationalize that. You know, so it's, it does seem as though there's the possibility of getting really entranced and engaged in figuring it all out, which might not exactly be what.
Yeah, and then you find in a moment the thing that's happening is rage and the desire to hurt somebody.
Yeah, right.
And what uppercase dharma steps in there and helps you, you know, what in the whole practice of your life is there for you happens along with the rage and the urge to hurt somebody. You know, where the rubber hits the road. How did we get there in a way so as to not harm, so as to move in the direction of the good, so as to move in the direction of awakening? How does that happen? Sue?
Yeah, I think that in the midst of rage or upset, the place of benefit is to recognize it and what is the most beneficial outcome, or what, you know, what can I call it? Because the worst thing is to, if you're in an argument, which I was today, to figure out whose fault it was first. Causes, you know, you want to get down to how it started, the origin of it. It was sort of a useless, futile energy.
In family systems work, the classic thing on that is, if you're working with couples, one person said, well, I withdraw because you nag. And the other person said, well, I nag because you withdraw.
Always doing it again is about that. That's
yeah, and so it. Actually it's usually referred to in the family systems therapy says it's arbitrary punctuation of continuous flow. but that's what we do. We punctuate. You know, we say this. I'm starting from this point. Oh, you're starting from that point, and it looks pretty different.
And you know, in this whole part with the dharmas, with the particularly, I'm thinking about the Eightfold Path, and the precepts that we work with, which are also dharmas. And you know, this is you know, one person withdraws because the other person nags, one, you know, and how an argument happens. And I think about Martin Luther King Jr. saying, you know, at some point somebody has to stand up and say, no, not going forward with this. You know, somehow that dharma comes up. That dharma originates in the moment and arbitrarily punctuates a flow that otherwise would keep going. I think I saw a hand over here. Uh-huh.
Thank you. My question is, what are the signs of starting getting out of awareness and going to the realms of Sankaras, and before we get in the center of the storm of involving with all those, what could be the sign, what can be the sign of, you know, getting out of, you know, mindfulness? And especially the point of decision making. It's important to not be involved with any specific thing and be mindful and make a decision, but how we can make it, how we can be sure that in this point of decision making, we are mindful. What are the signs of that? How we can recognize?
That's a good question. How to recognize when mindfulness is present? When mindfulness, when there is mindfulness, when there is not mindfulness. My sense of it is more we have a sense of when there is not mindfulness because it hurts. But I'd love to hear from other people. Peter?
Oh, you were referring to making choices, is that right? Decisions, choices?
A part of that is...
Yeah, and it was a question about how do we know when we are being mindful in decision-making or making choices? Is that right?
It's not just about making choices, but also one part of this, you know, one kind of decision-making is choosing among the choices.
Right.
But we have many different types of decision-making.
Okay, but that's the kind you're interested in. Okay. The other thing that came to me was, in reference to that, was is there a sense of freedom? You know, is choice really choice? And maybe that's a sign that you are mindful of the possibilities or mindful of what's present in the situation, if you're making decisions. Or as opposed to being driven by, you know, thinking you're making the decision, but really it's just you're being driven by something else that you're not aware of.
I was going to say that sometimes when I don't know how to make a decision, I feel ambivalent about a situation. I flip a coin. You know, I'll say, okay, heads will be this and tails will be that. And I flip a coin, and then the coin sort of tells me what I'm supposed to do, and then I recognize or I feel how I feel about that. Am I disappointed by that, or am I?
You keep flipping. Let's try the other one.
it's just one way to help me bring myself to an awareness of how I really feel about it and what's really going on in me. Maybe trying to bring forth the mindfulness, if you will. It's not there when I'm starting out.
I was thinking, basically, you know, when an action takes place, a thought forms, or a word comes out of your mouth, or you do something, that there's some volition somewhere along the way. So it's not like there wasn't. I mean, so you can see the output. You can see the output. You're seeing it way down the line. You're not seeing where the choice was made. So often we watch people's reactions and people's actions, and maybe they don't know where it came from, but at some point in their mental process, there was some volition there. There was some intention that came up in that sequence of events that led to whatever it is the outcome is. And looking for that, actually, searching for that. I mean, why did I say that?
Yeah.
How could I have done that?
Reverse engineering.
Yeah.
And some decision was made. Mind object formed, some sequence of feelings happened, and then there you were.
Yeah, and then that becomes part of what you bring to the next time.
Yeah.
You know, your own self developing dharma, you know, learning School of Hard Knocks.
I'm wondering if the question also had something in it about safety, that when I want to make a decision, I want to make a decision that's going to be safe, which I suspect that safety is not the best choice of criteria for the decision. If I'm always looking for a safe decision, for the right decision, sometimes I'm paralyzed and no decision, or you know, don't do anything decision is the one that arises. So sometimes I have to just jump off the, I just have to do something.
Yeah.
And not worry about the safety of it.
Walk the 100-foot pole.
Yeah.
John? Yeah, one of the things I find it's just really, really helpful for myself in terms of, you know, mindfulness, and sort of the question sort of where am I, what's going on, is checking in with my body. I mean, it's just a real crucial thing for me, because when you know, when I, if my body is not relaxed and at ease, and if I feel as if my energy is, you know, up above the neck, and that's where everything's taking place, the whole universe just exists from here on up, you know, I'm not being the least bit mindful. But it's just this kind of question of, like, you know, just, you know, you know, we talk about here again and again, it's like, you know, where's your breath, you know, when we're doing things, awareness of your feet, where are you standing, what's going on, it's just like these basic, very, very body things of, you know, it's like, this is a body process, mindfulness. So, and it's, for me, it's like, if I'm unsure of something, it's like, you know, what's happening inside this body right now? What am I aware of?
Just to underline or add a little to what John's saying in answer to your question for science, if it feels supple and pliant, that's usually a good sign. And if it feels rigid or kind of hard, that's usually a little bit of a warning, for me anyway.
So I'm seeing the timekeeper. We'll have a five minute break, I think, yeah. And please try to maintain 2 minutes.
Yeah.
3 minutes.
Two.
A very short break. Please try to remain silent during that time.
I wanted to put in a footnote about continuity and stuff, because it wasn't until the late 19th century that mathematicians were finally able to understand the concept of continuity.
But you might like this. I remembered this. On arising and passing away.
It did that just a bit. He's just saying it.
That's pretty good.
He just showed it to us.
I asked everybody to maintain silence, so I think we should do it. Okay. So I took a different tack, and basically
basically went back to why are we doing all of this anyway? And it felt a lot, reading this, or reading these approaches, felt a lot like reading Nagarjuna on the talking about the middle way, basically. Basically, all of these mindfulness practices are leading to the same place. So, which dharma, which phenomenon that you're looking at is irrelevant in a way, in taking this view of it. It just, because every dharma, and looking at every dharma, we learn the same thing. Basically, we learn that it's impermanent, we learn that it's empty, we learn that it rises and falls. So we just repeat this pattern, this formula, over and over again of how we deal with everything. And so it felt very formulaic to me. But I also went back to looking at kind of what we mean by a mental object. What do we mean by a mental object? And so I thought about and why is it important, and how does it come to be? And through the investigation of each dharma, that's what we look for, is where does it come to be? What are the processes that happen? What's going on as these things happen? And the basic happening is a phenomena arises, and there's a series of reactions that we have, and part of one of those reactions is the formation of a mental object. And that mental object is something that we store, that we construct, so that it no longer exists as some external object that becomes our own construction, and we put those in a pile and we store them away in our storehouse consciousness, and they begin to have a life of their own. But never forgetting, and that's where the issue starts. It starts with the initial contact. It starts with the contact with the sense organ or the mind organ, and then proceeds from there in terms of our reaction. I thought about the Sandokai. We chant eye and sights, ear and sounds, nose and smells, tongue and taste, thus with each and everything, depending upon these roots, the leaves spread forth. In other words, all these inputs that we have are the source, and the rest of it, the contact of the eye organ with a stimulus, is all that it takes for us to begin our construction of a world of suffering for ourselves. The only thing that happens really externally is that initial contact. Everything else is kind of an interdependence of things that are going on with the different parts of our consciousness and the different parts of our minds. So we store these in this, and we store them, and we construct then this sense of separateness based on the mental objects that we use or that we construct, and then based on that, we just start to develop patterns of reactivity that come from these patterns. These stored pictures, these stored mental objects, become the way that we react. An example of this would be if anger arises, we have a mental picture, a mental object of anger, and a whole way of reactivity pattern that we deal with that mental object. For example, we often
have an idea that when we feel angry, that means that someone externally has done something to us, has wronged us. And then we have a certain way of reacting to that. So we might, and that way of reacting then creates a kind of cycle of karmic actions that have effects in the world that are harmful to us. And all of that is, based on this same delusion of separateness and permanence, and basically the basic ignorance. So to overcome our ignorance, the sutra tells us to be present and curious about all the dharmas, and to ask questions about them. And it does this in this repetitive way, but then it basically comes up with a formula. So it gives us a formula for every time we encounter a mental object arises for us from contact with a phenomenon. We go through the series of questions, and I think Catherine talked about them. How does a monk remain focused on mental qualities in and of themselves with reference to the five hindrances? There is a case where there being sensual desire present within a monk discerns there is sensual desire present within me. He discerns how the arising of the non-arisen sensuality comes to be. He discerns how there is an abandoning of sensual desire once it has arisen. And he discerns how there is no future arising of sensual desire that has been abandoned. This sequence is repeated for all of the same dharmas. And so we are just given a formula, and it's kind of irrelevant what the particular dharmas are. Whatever we encounter, we treat in the same way. We treat with this curiosity, with asking these questions and these observations. So I thought about the lists a lot, and whether or not given, because I was resistant to the lists. And so I thought, well, is there a list that I use? Is there a favorite list? Bob said, you're going to tell us about the list, right? So I sort of decided on a list. This is the list that I use, and it is a list that I'm going to fall on my face with this. So here's a list. This is a list for me that I use, that actually similar to Lori's, that she gave a talk on some time ago. And it's basically pulling apart our creation of mental objects and our creation of by using mindfulness to look at all the steps, all the basic steps that underlie all of the phenomenon, our experience with all of the external phenomena. So it starts, these are called the five ever-present mental factors, and I like them because they're ever-present. So I can have them for any situation without picking up a different list. So here's the first ever-present factor is contact, and that's what Catherine was talking about, is bare awareness. Basically, some object meets our sense organs, or some object arises in our mind, some dharma arises in our mind, and that it is just there. Contact, if we just stop at contact, we just have this experience. We see the color red, we have the experience. If we stop at that, if we let it go, there we are. No karma is created. But generally, what happens is we go from contact to discrimination or discernment. We talked a little bit about that last week. So what happens there is then we start checking into our storehouse consciousness. We start checking into our mind consciousness and our sense consciousness. We start checking in with the other parts of our mind. And we start making descriptions of what this phenomena is. So it's red, it's square, it looks like a female figure, it looks like a male figure. So we start to use our mind to tell us something about what was happening with this contact and the bare awareness. If we left it a bare awareness, it would just be, I read. Now it's not. Now it becomes something because we immediately are creating here.
And the minute we start to create, we start creating a separate object. We start creating an object that has certain characteristics, and then we check in with our memories and our storehouse consciousness, so we have some reactions to that. So pretty soon we have created a separate mind object. We pulled up an object, or we've created an object, and it's an object that's separate from us that has certain characteristics. If we sit with that, maybe we can go a little deeper and do more discernment, more being with that object rather than reacting or feeling, but we're just more curious with that object and we let ourselves be with that. But then, almost always, and often, we don't even see this part because we go contact, storehouse consciousness, and feeling. So we bypass the actual discrimination or discernment process to get into the feeling part. And the feeling part is primarily there's some actual sense organ response, but also a lot of the feeling, the emotional feeling, as opposed to just the sensate feeling, is really something that has been created a long time ago. The seeds of this have been created a long time ago, so it's a programmed response. It becomes a programmed response after a while. And so we have our automatic responses. But then there is the next part of the ever-present mental factor of intention or volition. And that is really important to me because that is a factor where we have a choice. We have free will. We can form an intention. We have a picture of what's going on. We have our mental object. We have our feelings about it. But we don't have to react as if it's real. If we react as if it's real, then we want it. We might want it. We might have an aversion to it. We might be indifferent to it. But some volitional or intentional intention which results in volitional action, then. And this is where our habitual responses are. So this is where we end up over and over again getting caught in some repetitive harmful action or a grasping action or an aversion action that we have that we're programmed to do. And the last ever-present factor is attention. And Catherine talked about that a little bit. And that is just that is basically paying attention to the rest of it. So if we concentrate our attention, then we're aware of the contact, and we're aware of the discernment process or the discrimination process. We're aware of the feeling, and we're aware of the volition. So I like that list because for me it kind of speaks to the dynamism of what goes on as we're going through this and how quickly it races around with each other. And the whole point of these...
Can I just ask a question?
Sure.
Would you say that attention is what we're talking about is mindfulness in this sutta?
Yeah, I think so. I think attention is mindfulness, but it has a certain energy to it that feels like it also has some effort involved.
Yeah, that ardent...
The ardent paying attention. It's not
calmly
doing a body scan.
It's ardent and alert and directed.
It's connected with volition rather than your attention is drawn to some object of desire or hatred or whatever. It's not that kind of attention. But the attention that's more in volition is what you're talking about.
Like paying attention.
Yeah.
Yeah, being really paying attention. Right. So... I think what I like about this is the slowing down of everything, because you can catch it at any point. You can catch it at a point where you immediately go to constructing your mental object. You can catch it at a feeling state. You can catch it at different places, but paying attention to it slows everything down. Just like asking the question, when did it arise? I mean, all of these things
seem to me to be designed to throw, to slow everything down and to develop a pattern of how you react to phenomena. Every phenomena gets reacted to by, oh, this phenomena, what happened? How did it arise? What was the contact? What's the feeling associated with it? What am I making out of this contact? What have I constructed here? So it's a pattern of being. And it doesn't really matter which of the negative hindrances or which of the wholesome factors or which of these lists of things you're coming in contact with, they all kind of come from the same process.
So you're saying this attention is sort of like, you know, part of or triggers sort of an analytical process to go back and kind of...
Well, an observant process. I don't know about an analytical process, but it's like when I start to look at how something arose, right? How did it arise? This is kind of how I would look at kind of how did it arise? You're talking about how did it arise? It arose from the unarisen, you know. So how did this arise? How did this pass away? Because you can watch this process. And depending upon your, you can see something, you can discriminate and make something out of it, and then you can kind of check in with your past experience or you can say, this is an unwholesome feeling, I'm going to just let this one go. So you have you can slow it down at each place and stop the kind of the progression to the point where you get into this perhaps harmful volitional action. So I was thinking about the thing that where he was talking about the monk being sensual, right? Mm-hmm. So the monk sees object of potential sexual desire, but necessarily monk sees woman. You know, without the monk sees person, being, monk sees being. Then discrimination happens. Oh, this being has blonde hair. This being has a nice figure. This being, you know, so pretty soon a construction of a desirable being has been created. And then that triggers the feeling of, oh, desire. I want this. This being that I created separate from myself is something that I can desire. So now I want that being. And so then I have to go through my intention. I have to kind of, then I get, if I can stop myself or think about it, then I can kind of look at, okay, now what's going on here? How am I reacting to this? What kind of mental action am I taking, which is dwelling, could be dwelling on it? I could be dwelling on it, or I could say something, or I could do something that all would then have, you know, some karmic effects.
And also, you know, at that point of, I'm this celibate monk and I'm noticing the arising of desire,
right,
here, you know, if I'm schooled in the hindrances, I may think, oh, desire, that's a hindrance.
Yeah. Right.
I might think of my vow.
Yeah.
You know, naturally arising because it's so completely internalized into who I am at that point, that it naturally arises at that point and affects whether I dwell on it or I don't.
Right, and if you're mindful of that process,
yeah,
the process is slowed down enough that by the time you really feel the feeling, you're feeling the feeling in your body and your mind, so that it's not like you can do something stupid before you notice.
Yeah.
So it seems like in this scenario here, that's the place where there's really the opportunity to, you know, come with the question, how do I want to create my internal and external world?
Yeah.
To make a choice there. It's also the most dangerous place because, you know, volitional action creates a bigger impression in your consciousness or something. Like it's karma.
Yeah, that's where the karma happens.
Action,
yeah,
that's where it's happening.
That's where the karmic action happens.
It seems like some of the earlier phases, you're gonna have to be pretty slow, pretty slow down to get that.
Well, Yeah, I remember Alexander talking a lot about the slowing down. About the slowing down and how critical that is as we, you know, as we apply this in formal sitting meditation and then take it out the gate into, you know, where we can't slow it down quite as much, but that what we've trained ourselves in comes up in those moments.
Yeah. I mean, there was another diagram that I couldn't find, but it was too complicated to show anyway. But it was kind of then following from the volitional action, which comes out of generally desire or aversion. Then these other negative factors start to happen. So you kind of have, they sprawl out from that place of desire then. Mm-hmm. A whole bunch of other negative mental factors will show up, or a place of wholesome action, or wholesome action, then positive wholesome mental factors. But when you start to trace it back, looking at the outcome of it, that's another that you can start back. That you can start with the volitional action,
the learning process taking place by sort of, oh, I got myself into mess here. How did I get here? And that becoming part of what you bring to the next time.
Right. The other list that I thought was helpful for me in terms of actually are regularly using these lists in some kind of meaningful way on a day-to-day basis was when the kind of end of the section really goes from all of these other dharmas, from all of the more complex or remote dharmas to the Four Noble Truths, and then what's associated with dealing with the causes of suffering is sometimes called the six realms, which is craving, freedom from craving, anger, absence of anger, harming, and non-harming. So it seemed, again, looking into craving and being mindful of craving, that points again to some process in which I have constructed something separate from myself. So it's again going back to, I've constructed a mental object separate from myself that I want. And so looking at spending time on looking at where craving came from in this sequence of events, where craving came from, and where craving, and when craving lets go, and anger, these are the kind of which you generally comes from an aversion process. How that is arising from this process. What are the habitual reactions, and what are the habitual patterned responses to anger, and how I see those arise or not arise, knowing that when these strong feelings, these basic feelings of desire and craving or aversion and anger come up, they're based on the original construction of something separate, and I have to go follow them back to where that process started, to where that creation of the separateness in this particular situation started, and have to go back to how it was constructed, and how, again, what a kind of stored responses, stored memories, and stored pictures there are that actually brought this stuff up. So I was, and I was thinking about
if I look at anger, if I look at the anger, I can see the color of the anger. I can feel the anger in my body, where it's affecting my body, and my body can be tense and painful. And then I can also watch the patterns of reaction to that anger. If that anger results in hurtful speech, in hurtful action towards others, then I know that's karmic action, that action is going to cause harm. And then if I practice letting go of that anger, then I can experience, and I watch the letting go of that anger, I can experience the relaxation of the body. I can experience the place where I make a decision to take action in that situation or not take action. And I can feel what that feels like, and I'm mindful of what that feels like. So I can see the whole picture as I'm doing it, and in that, and slow it all down in a way so that I get a chance to actually perhaps transform what would be a habitual pattern. So if I have a pattern that tends to be reactivity in a certain way, as I slow it down and as I watch taking a different action, making a different choice, a different volitional action, then I can also watch it backwards.
This is like the lesson plan for the karmic school of hard knocks.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, if you think about attention as mindfulness, and this process that allows us to kind of step into different points along the process, at what point does mindfulness open up the transaction so that emptiness actually flows into it? Because you talk about creating a construct that is self, that is other. And emptiness tells us that this self doesn't exist, that your story is really my story, that there is no difference between us, and that we're all really interconnected. And so then the construction of the self, where's the thing that's entering into this for you?
What was that last thing?
As you walk through this process, where does emptiness enter into it for you, and how does it inform the different stages of the transactions?
The fact that you can watch the change and the process happen, and you can watch it go. That very watching of this pattern that you're making something out of nothing. And that if you stop making something, then there isn't anything separate from you. If you stop at that place where I make that separateness, where I create that form separate from myself, so you can, if you watch yourself create it, you can watch that it's a mirage, something that you've totally fabricated yourself.
I mean, I've had this experience. I'll use a very common example of traffic, for example. I'll be driving along, somebody will cut me off. The first reaction is rage. And over with great detail about what the transaction looks like. But at some point, I get in front of that and I breathe. Then all of a sudden, I realize that I connect with the person in the car. That I don't have to create karmic action, because really, this is all just my mental illusion. And that if I come back to the present moment, then I can be in the here and the now, in the place in which I sit, and I can proceed along at some kind of a pace.
Yeah. So, do we have any other discussion? Yeah?
I have a mini question, which is about one of the dharmas. This often came up in other discussions, which is, you know, on these lists of dharmas and other qualities, you never see the word fear, which often seems to be something that people identify as, you know, something they know about that exists, or, you know, whatever. And so I was just thinking about that and wondering whether or not it's something about agitation that's born of the recognition that either I'm going to get something I don't want, or I'm not going to get something I want. You know, it's either in a, you know, connected to either with desire or ill will or aversion. So it's some kind of agitation about that. Anxiety, or intense anxiety about it.
I don't know. Anyway, I'm trying to deconstruct the word into the language that we have in front of us.
The mental construction of fear?
Yeah, that's, you know, something that identifies fear is something that, that I don't see a word for it in the Dharmic language that I'm familiar with.
Well, Chogyam Trungpa has a wonderful piece on the four foundations of mindfulness that's quite different from what we usually get.
Yeah.
And he names the foundations quite differently. Mm-hmm. And where we usually have the mindfulness of feeling, mm-hmm. he calls it mindfulness of life. And he says that at its base, it is raw anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
And that it is raw anxiety about survival.
Yeah.
And that is what underlies, you know, the Satipatthana Sutra talks about feeling in terms of positive, negative, or neutral. And what he says is support survival, threaten survival, doesn't have anything to do with survival.
Yeah.
And that's all about fear.
Right.
Yeah, and it's just because we're bodies.
Yeah.
There's another sutra, the Buddha Tukha Sutta, which actually talks about fear and anxiety, and actually looks at because it's based on believing in a self that can die, basically.
Yeah.
And so by going through the same pattern of very meticulously taking things apart and looking element by element in the same way that this sutta is talking about, that Nagarjuna is talking about, if you take it apart bit by bit, then you see the emptiness of it. And then you are liberated. You no longer are subject to birth and death. So that ultimate anxiety of non-existence.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Is at the heart of it.
Or belief in a self.
Belief in a self.
And then you're subject to birth.
And then you're subject to birth and death.
Yeah. Or belief in a body.
Belief in a body that can deteriorate. And die.
That is I. Yeah. Belief that I am my body.
Yeah. And that is terrifying. Yeah. Old age and death, you know.
Right.
Yes?
I'd like to come back to volition and intention.
Mm-hmm.
Peter mentioned it's a way, a possible opening and a way in, which I think you've talked about.
Mm-hmm.
And he also mentioned it's a risky place. And I confess when you said, so we have free will. For me, the verdict's kind of still out on that one. This is actually a fairly serious issue for me. I'm pretty impressed with how I can form intentions, wholesome intentions, and have them totally fall apart and fail. It actually was about 10 years ago I had this pretty intense incident where I really was clear about my intention and summoned all of my willpower, etc., and totally wound up doing something that I really did not want to do, which had very bad consequences for me. And it was very humbling and scary. On the one hand, I'd kind of like to feel like intention and volition are helpful. On the other hand, I sometimes feel like the more I rely on volition, the more I reinforce my illusory sense of self. And if I don't rely on volition, the only thing I kind of know to do is sort of fall back on faith and just kind of practice and keep on doing it and hope that somehow this whole conglomeration of whatever somehow shapes things in some kind of positive direction. But every once in a while, faith kind of gets a little shaky too. So then I kind of go to intention.
Bob, what's the difference?
Oh, now that's interesting. What's the difference between intention and faith?
Yeah, isn't faith an act of intention?
Actually, not for me.
What was faith neglect?
Well, if I mean, you could, I can see you're putting it into an intention. I have faith in the teachings of the Buddha. I have faith in the vows.
Oh, yeah.
I have faith in the practice. Yeah. Therefore, I'll trust the practice.
I turn myself. You do something.
Right.
There's some giving. There's some surrendering to the practice.
There is an action. It's a karmic
action. Yeah, it is an act. Yeah. Yes.
Sort of like the sign of that. Yeah. I think that that if you don't, I mean, this, I'm like very new to all of this, so I can't reference any kind of Buddhist writings. This is just my own thoughts on this. That that if you don't have some kind of intention within yourself or some kind of volition in yourself, then there's always going to be some force out there. There's always going to be something that is going to cause you to act, right? So I think it's like, if you have the intention and you're consciously saying, this is my intention, and whether or not that action works one way or the other, like, you can't know, that's sort of the arbitrariness of life, I think. But it's like, it's kind of, there's this idea that, like, I mean, it's funny because there's the phrase, like, I did this sort of in good faith, you know, like, at least I know that when I started doing this, I had this intention, and I do believe that counts for something, whereas if you say, when I did this, I just said, you know, like, sometimes I have an intention, sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't, so I'm just not even going to have an intention, then I think in a way there is some, I mean, in terms of karma, which is kind of the way it's talking about sort of responsibility in a way for actions, I feel like that's why intention is important, but you can never know. You never know. I mean, sometimes you mean something
well, God, you want to say something? Well, I think you're getting at something important, especially when you said you never know, because intention, you know, intention conditions karmic effects, but we never really know what they are entirely. So, you know, our intention in living by vow is very important, and at the same time there's an enormous amount of faith involved because we don't know.
But there's also it's also a safety valve, the fact that we actually don't have to act on the feelings that come up.
So automatically.
Automatically. There's some place where we process that, right? We can feel murderous rage, and only a handful of people act on that. If everyone, you know, and some of it is biological and, you know, all this other stuff, but also the part of it is if I really do a vow and I really, that vow is really sacred to me, then the feelings don't turn into something that's unwholesome in terms of, I may still have a feeling that has an effect on me that's a negative and unwholesome effect just by having that feeling. But the way that I work with that feeling is different if I set an intention. Yeah?
I think our, you know, peers come up because of, I did this just quick mental experiment around, you know, intention. And if we talk about intention and we talk about it from a grounding in non-self.
Yeah.
That basically kind of pulls the rug out from under our normal way of thinking about my intention to do this or that. And what we're really left with when we talk about intention from that perspective is faith. It is the, you know, throwing body and mind into the house of Buddha. You know, it's that kind of intention that is there's no self. It's so that faith issue, I think, is just really kind of,
yeah.
That's all there is.
And we have to make an effort.
Yeah.
You know, we have to, the time comes when you have to make the call. You know, it comes kind of back to what Ahura was saying, you know, when I have to make a decision, when I have to do this or that, not do this or that. Whoa, how do I know if I'm being mindful, bringing my full self to it, dwelling in that place?
I didn't get there.
Oh, yeah, just signaling that...
Yeah, it's time.
He's waving the big stick.
Yeah, it doesn't mean that if there are any...
If there's anybody else who has anything to say. Yeah.
I just about something that your comment made me think about, and it came to me too that sometimes I really sway between having a really strong intention and then going on faith. But I just thought about the whole idea of gaining idea, and when I try to do something, and I think that this is what I really want, and then that faith and that intention, I end up learning something about myself that I didn't know before. And I think what really gets me in trouble is the whole concept of gaining something, getting somewhere.
So as opposed to
just.
Or as opposed to really the intention is to be compassionate to all beings.
Doing by the sake of doing,
yeah.
Without thinking that I'm going to get there. The concept of getting an idea just came up for me. Like if that has gotten me in trouble a lot. And you know, when I set up my intention and then I think I'm going to get somewhere, I always get somewhere, but it may not be necessarily where I thought I would get.
I really agree, and I thank everyone and appreciate your comments. I guess one other thought that sparked sort of tangential, because I don't have complete faith in the power of my intention, I'm sometimes very careful about what I put myself in contact with. Because that makes a big difference, and in terms of which intentions some are going to arrive.
Yes.
So I like your listed method. You can sort of go in any.
You can go in any. Yeah, they cut the arrows go all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
But going backwards when you start observing your whole pattern and what your intention or volitional action tends to be, you say, yeah. You can just skip directly to where it all starts.
Mm-hmm.